I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
I am very keen on this series. And I think that it does a series of things very new within the spy genre, completely successfully. It has a tone, or the series has a tone, which I think speaks to a very widespread sense of weariness, exasperation, disgust and even anger that many of us are feeling towards our politicians and governments at the moment, mixed with a very, may I say, sort of British sense of kind of cynical humour. I'm going to go back right to the beginning, Mick, first. I'm going to say Slow Horses came out in 2010, so 9 years ago now. So you'd obviously writing it for a while before that. You'd written a series of contemporary detective novels before that, set in Oxford. What drew you to spy thrillers? I suspect that it was quite a surprising shift, even for you.
I probably knew I was going to do it before I started, yeah. I think. The previous novels had mostly been about about an individual, Zoe Bohm. I wanted to write about a group of people, so that was one of the main drivers for turning to write these particular novels. I had a location because Slough House does actually exist as a building, and it's very near where I was working at the time. I used to walk past it twice a day. I'm a very lazy writer. I won't go out of my way to do any research or go anywhere to explore anything. If something is right there presented to me, then that's what I use because it's easier that way. And I wanted to write about failure and boredom and frustration and all that sort of thing. I don't quite know where this came from, but I was at the time. Let me see, this would have been my sixth novel, and I was not successful. I was published, but I was not successful. Nobody was particularly reading the books. So coming to write about a group of people, and I had a day job. I was, in London every day, walking past this place near the Barbican to go to my office. So I was coming to write about a group of people who were being prevented from doing what they really wanted to do with their lives and instead were stuck in an office giving all sorts of boring stuff to do that they didn't particularly want to. And it took me a long time. I mean, literally, it was only a year or so that it occurred to me that this did kind of describe my own situation at the time. And I wanted to write about spies because I was writing thrillers and really the options are fairly limited. I could have written about police officers, but then I would have had to know what I was talking about because the activities and processes and procedures of police officers are publicly available. And if you start writing about them and get any of that stuff wrong, you will get emails about it. So that felt like too much hard work. So I thought writing about spies meant that I could make up anything I liked and people would just assume I knew what I was talking about, which does seem to have worked in as much as I get asked an awful lot whether I'm a spy or not, or have been a spy. And depending on my mood, I either answer this question honestly or I don't.
So you make it up. I'm very struck by the fact that you decided not to do lots of research about spying. That's the deal, is you did no research, it's none of that trying to embed yourself or anything like that.
No, it wasn't really a conscious decision as such, it's just my natural laziness, disinclination to do anything like that.
I'd really like you to talk a little bit more about being interested in writing about failure and boredom, because I think it's a really interesting choice. I mean, so much modern life, modern work in particular, involves being bored. And, you know, failure is such a kind of dirty word in the society that we live in at the moment. It's very hard, you know, it's only okay if you're sort of saying that you're learning from failure in order to kind of do better next time. I wondered what sort of drew you to that.
I just think it's more interesting because, well, happiness writes white, as the saying that Larkin used to quote all the time. Montanat, I think, came up with the original. And that seemed to me, over the past few years, not so much now, but a few years ago, there was a strain in genre fiction which was very reliant on wish fulfillment. The protagonists were always very, very good at what they did. They always seemed to have a lot of money and a nice apartment. And they, you know, they drank nice wine, they read the right books and everything. And then this just seemed to be crap, really. I mean, nobody lives a life like that, surely. And if they do, it's not very interesting. It must be a nice life to live, but it's not particularly interesting to read about. Failure is far more interesting because it brings all sorts of things to the surface. A few years ago, I remember I read a very interesting interview with a British character actor who said that his first starring role had been in a Mike Leigh film, and the film was all about his character. You probably all know how Mike Leigh works. You know, he doesn't work from a script as such. He works with his actors to come up with a backstory for the characters they're going to be playing, and scenes are improvised, and a lot of material is shot out of which the film is made. And this character actor knew that for the first time he was going to be, you know, playing the lead role in a movie. So he was quite surprised when he saw the film, and he's only in about three scenes. Because Mike Leigh had lied to him and told him it was all about him, and it wasn't, it's about a different character. But he got a great performance out of this character actor for the scenes that he was in, because, you know, he thought this was, you know, that his actor
he was the most important thing.
This was the main person in the movie. And that seems to me to be very true to life, because we are all
the heroes of our own stories.
We're all the protagonists of our own narrative. Everybody else is kind of playing a bit part. So I was quite interested in having a bunch of characters, all of whom thought that they were the central character, that they are the hero or the heroine, and have them essentially bumping heads, because, of course, they're not. None of them are doing anything particularly important. But that meant that when the opportunity to do something arose, they would all grab it with both hands, because although they're all in this kind of exile situation where nothing important is going on, every so often some kind of opportunity will arise. And they will leap for it, even though that's a very stupid thing to do in many circumstances. And even though a lot of the time they're simply making a bad situation worse, they just want to be involved. They all wanted to be, you know, James Bond or whoever.
But it is one of the great successes, I think, of the series that, as you say, you have your characters. They start off each book kind of in this terrible, terrible kind of hell, kind of boredom office, and then they get an opportunity to get out. And actually, they invariably make things worse, or they fail, you know. And yet, the read is completely satisfying. I mean, I think it's a great achievement of the books. It's one of the things that makes them both fun and also really interesting. I suppose it's rather hard for you to comment on that.
I haven't really thought of it in that way. I mean, I plot as I go along, more or less. Mm-hmm. I kind of know where I'm going, and I certainly know where I'm starting from. But a lot of the time, I'm just kind of winging it in terms of creating the ins and outs of the plot. So their success, or otherwise, in the course of events in the novel, is it just kind of depends on how things
work
out.
How are you feeling?
Really.
Okay. Following on for this, one of the things that I find very original about the books are their tone. What I mean by this is that most spy fiction and most spy non-fiction, as we mentioned earlier, I wrote a biography of Anthony Blunt, and so years ago, and did a very great deal of research and a lot of reading of spy books. And a lot of stuff in this area is written with a very inbuilt and powerful sense of its own importance, its own heroics, its seriousness, the jeopardy, what's at stake. In non-fiction, pomposity is often one of the sort of key elements. And this is something I don't, which I find interesting, is very absent from your books. You know, for me, one of the interesting things about the series is that the books puncture a lot of the expected tropes of spy writing. You know, as we said, it's a world of failure and boredom and small-mindedness and vanity and fallibility. And I wonder whether, I do think it's very interesting what you said, that sort of conjoining of the boringness of office work and the spy. I mean, it is a sort of fantastic union, isn't it, of kind of current, it's like sort of call centre life. Mm. And grafted onto spy, you know, spy fiction.
I guess it is. A lot of what I do, or the reason why I'm writing this kind of book, is I'm simply trying to make a virtue out of my own limitations, because I don't know very much about anything, frankly. but what I do know is what it's like to work in an office. So that's why I was basing my characters sort of frames of reference within the office environment. When I started writing, it was 2008, when I started writing this series, and that was, you know, the banking crisis was just upon us, and from my own personal experience of working for a corporation, my feeling was that all large corporations are just dysfunctional.
Yes.
It's inevitable. And some of them are dysfunctional to a degree of absolute corruption, which we could see with what was going on in the banks at the time.
Sure.
And others are dysfunctional simply because they're run by people whose the levels of kind of middle management are just dominated by petty vanity and point scoring and personal ambition. And so I simply just
drafted
all that onto the spy novel, not because I thought I was doing anything new, but was because what I felt I could write about, what I kind of knew about to a degree. But
can you think of any other spy novels that sort of do that? The only thing there's a bit of, I thought we were talking earlier about Len Dayton and the sort of class of Harry Palmer.
But I reread an early Harry Palmer not long ago, last year, and I was quite struck, and this was written about, I think it was 63 or Source Underwater, and I was struck by the similarities, actually, and I had read those books when I was a teenager, and, you know, it's all in there somewhere. And this is
Not many of the others, I would have said. Not in anything else I sort of think of. I mean, not in Bond, obviously, but not really in Green, you know. Green and Le Carré, you know, they think they are sort of criticising the system, but it's very much from a kind of, you know, upper class perspective and from inside, it seems to me. You know? And they're very in love with the idea of its importance as well.
And they are. You know, I admire both those writers enormously.
Absolutely.
And I think there are a lot of cadences that I borrow from Le Carré here and there, probably more than some of them deliberate, but some of them I realise on rereading that this is where they're coming from, and it's not intentional.
When you say cadence, what do you mean by that?
I mean, the actual prose, the rhythms of the prose.
Really?
and so on. I noticed this the other day, just with this one, which was not... I wasn't intentionally doing a Le Carré, but the first sentence is, seasoned park watchers later said that the affair really began in Fishers, and it goes on from there. And that really is quite the carry out. It's not intended to be, but when you have such a huge example of how to write good, successful and literate spy fiction in front of you like Le Carré, it's impossible to avoid, sort of sounding like him at times.
I think he's managed to disguise it quite well. I mean, I think there are moments when one sees a sort of possibly a little almost a sort of element of pastiche, but it seems to me it's very sort of controlled. I don't think the rest of us are sitting here thinking it sounds exactly like Le Carré at all.
Well, my characters fart and swear more than his does.
They do. They do a lot more farting and swearing.
He sets the bar pretty low as far as that's concerned.
Yes, that's true. There's not a lot of farting and swearing in Le Carré. More's the pity, I suppose. Another thing I very much like about the books is the way... It's one of the things I like anyway about the thriller genre anyways, is the way that it allows one to kind of foreground a whole world. And one of the things that's particularly vivid, I think you say, you know, you're writing about a group of people, but you're also writing very strongly about a world, as you say, it's almost, you know, a corporation. Slough House and Regent's Park spring really from that first novel, very vividly and fully formed to life. And what I think is very interesting is, you know, exactly it does feel like. It feels like, you know, British intelligence, it feels appallingly and plausibly credible that modern intelligence is actually like a kind of badly run corporation, you know, as you say. And Slough House with its sort of dead flies and stained carpets, and Regent's Park with this shiny glass dome hub, but again, all these sort of awful narcissistic careerists and yes men and sociopaths. Mm-hmm. But you choose, as I say, to focus on Slough House rather than Regent's Park. Is there any bit of you that's sort of attracted to the shiny bit?
Only in as much as it gives me an opportunity to write about the politics of it and the connivingness of it. Because my characters in Slough House, I mean, sometimes they get called unlikable, which I disagree with, actually.
No, I think they're very likeable.
But they're not really conniving. I mean, they're just trying to do their best and they're trying to get back into a world that they're probably better off out of. That's the great thing about them. I mean, Lamb is going to keep them in Slough House, and he probably thinks it's just the best place for them. He doesn't want anything to do with Regent's Park, and he kind of rejects that whole side
world.
Of the whole world, really, because he's seen how dirty it can be, and he would far rather be in his actual squalor rather than what he sees as moral squalor.
Tell us a bit about Diana Taverner, then, as a sort of archetype almost of that shiny world.
Well, again, I mean, she does want to do her best, really, but she genuinely believes that she is the best person to be running the Secret Service, and she, throughout the books,
the best
goes
for her,
to,
isn't it, really?
She thinks the best, I mean, it will be the best for her, but she also thinks it's the best thing for the country that someone like her is doing this job. So she does manifest some pretty awful behaviour in order to get herself into that position. But it is fun writing about people doing
awful things.
Awful, unpleasant, underhand things, it has to be said.
Let's talk a little bit about Jackson Lamb. He's the presiding spirit of Slough House and, I suppose, the books. I just wanted to mention, you know, he, around his most described quality of farting, there are a myriad of priceless, I think, descriptions, my favourite of which is, I like a pun, so your description of his capacity for farting as being bottomless is cheap but good. I mean, presumably you take a bit of pleasure in that.
I think this was quoted in the Times as saying this the other week. What delights me about that is the way the language allows you to make that joke. I think it's tremendous. I do enjoy puns and I do enjoy the wordplay, but it's a lot of what I put in Lamb's mouth when he's saying really quite unpleasant, bigoted things is just the joy of using that language in a way that is both, you know, it's probably pretty offensive a lot of the time, but it's also funny.
And liberated in its way.
Yeah, and free. But the fact that the language, as I say, allows you to be funny and unpleasant at the same time is quite delightful.
How did you put him together? How did he come to you?
Slowly is probably the right And so he was never intended to be any more important a character than any of the others. I mean, in Slow Horses, the main character is arguably River Cartwright, the young agent who starts. He certainly thinks he's the most important character in that book and all the books since. He hasn't quite learnt his lesson yet.
But he's young.
He's
foolish.
Yes, he's managed to stay quite young, despite the fact that he's been doing this for some years now. I shade over details like, chronology and stuff like that.
The Simpsons.
Yeah, quite.
Just think about The Simpsons.
I haven't, but I will now. What was I saying?
You were talking about, I was asking you how whether Jackson sprang fully formed or whether it took a while.
There was a period when I thought he might not actually appear in the books on the page, you know, that he would simply be a malign presence in his attic office that the others would talk about, but he would never actually appear. But once I started writing, I changed my mind about that. And as soon as I realised how much fun I could have with a character who doesn't appear to have any boundaries, then it became obvious that he would be there on the page. I haven't done this myself, but I think if you go through the novel, this is a job for somebody when you get home tonight, go through the novels and take out all the pages on which he appears. I'm sure he's not actually in the books that much. But when he does appear, and this has probably increased throughout the novels, he's kind of turned up to 11 in a way that the other characters aren't. So he spreads out into the margins in a way that they don't.
Yes,
but you never know what he's thinking or feeling. You just sort of see him in action, as it were. Whereas all the other characters, I write scenes from their points of view. So you know what they're going through, you know how they feel about it, and you know what they, you know, what they hope and wish for. So the other characters really have more ballast to them than Lan himself does. But he's probably more memorable simply because he is a grotesque. And grotesques are always the characters that kind
people
of
remember.
Loom in the imagination more than any others.
Dickensian. Yeah. I think that's very interesting because I was just thinking, I've always thought of him as what in our house we call a Mr. Woog. Which is, you know, he's the character that everybody talks about, you know, and they build him up and you never see him. And then finally Mr. Wu arrives. And it almost doesn't matter what Mr. Wu's right, because but actually it turns out that Jackson Lamb completely fulfills his promise.
Right.
But as you say, he's a presiding spirit rather than a central character.
He often does kind of act and you know, put things right or wrong.
Well, he's the most effective person, arguably, in all the books. Whether in Regent's Park or Slough House.
Oh, yeah, yes. I mean, on one level, you think if he'd actually, you know, get his act together and shave and shower and so on, he could actually run Regent's Park if he wanted to. But he does not have any interest in doing that. Mr. Wu was Steely Dan song. Sorry, is that where you got it from?
Sorry, I'm going to have to ask my husband. Where does Mr. Wu come from?
It's an Orson Welles line.
There
okay,
you go.
Thank you.
There we go. Mr. Wu.
Orson Welles was a model for Lan. If I had a
Oh, that's a
model,
very, very good
if
idea.
If I had a model, Touch of Evil, you know, when he's
Brilliant.
Really particularly sallow and oily and so on. That's
Bloody wish I'd asked that question first, but I'm so very pleased it came out. Anyway, you decided specifically not to give him, you choose not to excavate him. And clearly there's, you know, I imagine there's a lot of kind of pain and, what's the word, self-loathing underneath here, you know. But you have always decided to keep away from that in him.
Yeah, I think the self-loathing is pretty clear.
Self-evident, yeah.
And fairly clearly there's damage there in the background somewhere. But I'm not interested in exploring what that is, because I think if you tinker with a character like that and bring backstories out into the light, it spoils them. I think we can probably all think of characters that's been done. Hannibal Lecter, okay.
Yeah, you just don't want too much.
Once you explore his history, he loses any kind of danger or charm.
I think that's absolutely right. I was just thinking, though, as you say, with certain other characters, you choose to enter their lives and their minds much more. And I'm thinking particularly, I mean, I think the characters that sort of anchor us as readers to the series, the people who make, you know, who are useless, but we identify them and we have come to like them. And we want them not to fail, and they fail again and again. I'm thinking of Louisa Guy. Mm. I'm thinking of River. And perhaps most of all, Catherine Standish, who is the 50-something ex-alcoholic, who has a sort of, I think, as the books go by, a sort of battle-hardened nobility about her. She's a really appealing character. And it's, you know, somebody whose life is extraordinarily quiet, really. Somebody who has been sort of destroyed in so many respects by life, but who's sort of held these sort of shreds of her dignity. And there's something very, very admirable about her, I think.
And she's probably my favourite character of them all. I think that she's the heart and conscience of Slough House. But very much for those reasons. There are several points in many of the novels where I indicate how difficult it is for an alcoholic simply to get to work in the morning without encountering temptation.
Yeah.
And it's just everywhere.
Yeah.
And so you need an inner strength to survive all that on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And so her life is very quiet. But it is essentially a triumphant life. Because
absolutely.
Things have gone very slightly differently for her. She wouldn't be there now.
At all.
She would be, you know, she'd be on the streets. And she's very conscious of that.
And he respects her, I think, Jackson, in his
he
horrible
has an odd way.
Way
of showing it.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. He's horrible to her, but you feel that of all of them, he sort of does respect. I mean, he tortures her, doesn't he?
Yeah. They have a history that, you know, of a relationship which oddly enough, she isn't entirely aware of. He knows more about it than she does. And I do touch on that in this book. I say I don't go very far into Lamb's background, but there is a scene in this novel where it's just a conversation between the two of them, and it goes further back into the past than I'd ever gone before with either of them. And it's exploring essentially it's exploring the nature of their relationship, but it's also bringing in other things that happen. Yeah.
One of the pleasures of the series, I think, is that you're able to kind of have overarching themes, and also you're able to kind of reveal little bits about people through the books. It's one of the great, I think, lovely things about a series, you know, and a series that sort of moves on. So that, I imagine that was quite deliberate. You thought you'd sort of drip feed us.
I'm glad I give that impression. Very, very little of it is conscious. I put things in as they occur to me, and trying not to be untrue to anything I've written in the past. Mm. I don't really have an overall arc in mind. Although with this book, with Joe Country, I decided as I got to the end that I'd throw in. It's not quite a cliffhanger, but there's something happens right on the last page, and I had no idea where I was going with that. I just thought, if I end it like that, then I'll have to actually do some work next time. So I'd have to go on.
I've got to point out, you know, having made us like these characters, you are not slow to do a Games of Thrones on and kill off major characters. Was that a sort of early decision? Is that, did you not kill off a rather major character in your previous series?
I refuse to answer that question.
Okay, very good.
Okay. It may contain a spoiler.
Okay, very, very well done, can I say?
I always knew that I was going to... one of the points of having a larger cast was that I would be able to do this, I would be able to dispense with characters, because it makes for a memorable reading experience, I think, if you've grown to like a character over not just one novel, but more than one novel. Once a character's been in more than one book, you tend to think of them as being inviolable. You know, you think that this is, you know, they're part of the set, as it were. You only have to kill one person to make all other characters nervous, because they never know when they're in danger, whether it is actually going to be the end for them. But I never do it lightly, and I never decide in the middle of a book, oh, I know what would liven this up, I'm going to kill somebody off in the next chapter. The death of the character is always one of the pieces of information I have when I start to write a novel. It's always going to be, this is the novel in which X is going to die. And I make very clear on page 3, I think, of Joe Country, that this is a novel in which several characters meet their end. Well, you don't find out who they are until much further on in the book. With this book in particular, with Joe Country, it actually started off with an image. Normally my imagination is triggered verbally. I mean, I'm more interested in words on the page than in any other form of input or output. But with this, I had an image in my mind of a snowy hillside with a tree on it and somebody sitting underneath the tree. And I knew that this person was dead. And I knew that they were a character that I'd worked with for a long time. It appeared in many previous books. So the whole of the novel, plotting the novel, was a matter of creating the context in which I could allow that scene to take place. That's how, for me, a lot of plotting works. I have a kind of destination in mind, and I've got an idea of a theme or whatever, and it's simply a matter of, I always know where they start, because they're always in Slough House to start with, and it's just simply finding a route from this starting point to the end point that I have in mind, or midway point or whatever, and then track away from it. With this one, I felt it's very important that when something like that happens, and it comes to me quite forcefully, that I do go with it. I can't think, actually, I don't want to kill that character. I mean, I could have decided that. But I'm not sure what I would have done otherwise, because this is how my imagination works, and this is how the books get created. So once that was there, I had to be true to it. And also, in a way, I felt a moral obligation to do this, because this was, as I say, it's a character that I've worked with for a long time. And it's a very privileged profession, being a writer, because it means that you can't take people you've worked with for a long time, and you can kill them. Now, you're not allowed to do this in office life, trust me. And I felt that I would be betraying all those other office workers, of whom I was one for many, many years, if I didn't take the opportunity to kill a colleague when it was presented to me on the plate. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't bring me any great happiness to do this. But on the other hand, it also allows me to bring in new characters all the time. So it refreshes the series, at least from my point of view, because I have new characters to explore, new characters to write about. And I can think of many books where other novelists have done this. And take Ed McBain, for instance. Ed McBain's 87 Precinct series. There are more than 50 books in the series. Most of them I've read more than once. A lot of the time, you know, trying to remember what they're about, they kind of merge. But I remember the books where he kills off one of his main characters, and he does it, you know, a number of times over the half century or whatever he was writing those books. So it makes for a memorable experience. Not necessarily a happy one, but a memorable one.
I've just realised where some of that nasty dry humour comes from. Okay. Do you have a process for developing characters, or do they come to you? Or do you rewrite and rewrite them?
I do a lot of rewriting. Yeah. But a bit of both. I mean, in one sense, there's a kind of sort of cookie cutter there, because if my characters are going to turn up, have a new character in Slough House, that means there must be an issue there that goes with them. There has to be a reason why they're there. So there's damage of one sort or another. So I know that, you know, I've got that to start with. And I know I don't want to keep repeating myself, so I have to think of a new kind of damage to portray. But I find that, and I think this is probably common to many fiction writers, that the act of creativity allows you access to thoughts you didn't know you had. So as soon as I can think about, you know, a character that they're going to be, have this, you know, wrong with them, and they're going to look vaguely like this, and so on. But once I actually start putting them on the page and giving them thoughts in their head and feelings in their heart and words in their mouth, then that's when they start to become, that's really? When it can spark. They start to become, not real so much, but they flesh out. And
yes.
I see what kind of character they're going to be on
so
the page.
So words and almost building
words
up characteristics
by themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
but all the work is done in the back of your mind, really, and this kind of creative stuff. A lot of it is going on in the subconscious or whatever. And once you start doing the work, that all comes out and sort of finds expression in a way that you didn't know was going to happen. This happened to me with River Cartwright when I came up with his name. So this was at a very early stage in the process of writing Slow Horses. And I knew that I was going to have a young man who was in Slough House for reasons, you know, that he was set up in some way. I knew he was going to be called Cartwright. I didn't know what his first name was, but I knew it would have two syllables because I'm a very rhythmical writer. Rhythm matters to me, and I knew that it had to be Dudon Cartwright. It couldn't be Tom Cartwright. It had to be two syllables. And I went through every name I could think of, and some I probably shouldn't have thought of, and none of them quite worked. And I remember very well coming up with River. I was working at the time, and I got the train from London into Oxford every evening, coming back from work. Do you know the line? The old line, the one from Paddington. Comes over the river just before it gets into the railway station at Oxford. There's only about, if it's working properly, there's only about a minute or so between crossing the river and pulling up at the station. And being a trained commuter, I knew which door to be standing at to get off the train so that I was right next to the steps to be up and away out of the station straight away. So I was standing up as the train went over the river in the vestibule, and I thought, River, there's a name. The only river I knew at the time was River Phoenix, who was then, you know, then long dead, but that was the only time I'd come across it being used as a name. But as soon as I had that, the whole of his backstory came to me, because if he's called River, he had to have a parent who was a bit flaky, because you wouldn't call you River otherwise. Can I just check on this?
Anyone got a child
Two
called River?
Two separate occasions I've been telling this story, and somebody in the audience has turned out to have
Seriously.
A child called River. Seriously.
Okay.
Mind you, in both cases,
any
I can't
rivers,
prove my point.
Any rivers in the audience? Or no? Well, you're safe here.
And therefore, you know, if they were had a, their immediate parent, if River's immediate parent was, you know, kind of hippie type, then you had to have some other figure in the background that had imbued him with the sense of, you know, whatever it is that made him want to do a life of service with the Secret Service. So that's how his grandfather was invented. And therefore I knew that he had been basically abandoned by his mother and brought up by his grandfather. And that all came to me before the train arrived at the station in Oxford. And that's because I'd been, you know, thinking about it for a long time, and it was all just waiting there
to be given
birth. But it all comes out like that in one kind of rush. That's only happened to me on two occasions that I can think of, but that one is the one that I most remember. But it's nothing to do with, you know, sudden burst of inspiration or anything.
It's doing all
the toil beforehand, and then just allowing yourself, finding the access to the ideas, to the creativity that is within. Usually that comes by putting words on paper. It's usually at the typeface. Can you call it that? The typeface.
Yeah, I think that's rather good. I like that.
It usually happens at the typeface, but very occasionally it'll happen in a kind of abstract, theoretical way.
Let's move more. You talked already about how the rhythm of words is very important to you, how you enjoy puns. I mean, one of the another of the qualities of the books is their wit and their sharpness and your very evident pleasure in words. I was just thinking, I was just looking the other day at London Rules again, and there was an exchange that I felt sort of summed up a particular kind of deadpan thing that you do particularly well, when these two agents are discussing the difference between different kinds of sort of appalling behaviour. And the line was, blowing up 42 kids in a shopping centre is murder. Waterboarding a suspected terrorist to death, that's housekeeping. And I mean, there's a lot of that. I mean, one of the things, there's a line also I very much like from Catherine, we were talking about earlier. She says, having a cat is one small step from having two cats, and to be a single woman within a syllable of 50 in possession of two cats is tantamount to declaring life over. Do these ping into your head, or do you work at them? Are you a sort of three-draft man?
Oh, more than easily. Yeah. I mean, when I first expressed either of those things, it would have been a whole paragraph eventually working its way around to making that point. And then you just take out all the other words that aren't really adding anything, even though on the first, second, third, fourth read, it looks like every word is necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
You just keep taking the words out until you have to put that. If I went through any of my books now, I would, you know, even Joe Country, I'd probably just
take
be
more.
Taking more and more words out. Yeah.
But there is, you know, clearly the words matter. I mean, we know, you know, in genre fiction, there's often a big pressure to get a book out a year.
Right.
We both know that. And in fact, I think, you know, there are very few, very exceptional writers who can write something that's really good in a year. I mean, Lee Child is probably one of them. I always think those books are sort of better than they almost need to be. They're kind of amazing. And I notice your books have, you know, you have a certain sort of monk-like existence, I think. You know, you have a partner, but she doesn't live with you, and, you know, you don't have kids, and you clearly work very hard, and you don't have a TV. But, you know, you clearly take a great deal of care in writing, and words are clearly something that give you a very great deal of pleasure. It's not rushing to the end of the plot by any means.
No, it is a pleasure, and it's how I find fulfilment. I mean, I would be doing this even if they weren't being published, frankly. I mean, it's what I did it for a long time without being published. And I'm blessed with a publisher who, I mean, I accept what you say about genre fiction, but John Murray don't really publish genre fiction. They just publish the fiction that they
like. Kudos to them.
No pressure is put on me to produce, you know, on a kind of yearly basis, which is the case with a lot of publishers who want their authors to, you know, bang in a book every February so it can be produced every September or whatever. I don't have any of that kind of pressure at all. Thank you, Mark.
His publisher is actually just sitting at the back. We all love you, okay? We all want to be published by you. I want to move on now to talk a little bit about, before we take some questions, about satire and social observation, which I think is another really interesting and unusual thing in the books. One of the pleasures of contemporary crime writing is how sort of capacious, how its capaciousness has come to accommodate so much in terms of writing about society and politics. And I'm thinking about people like Ian Rankin and Denise Miner and Sarah Hillary and Eva Doan and plenty of others. And your books also do that. But as I was saying earlier, I think that there isn't a lot of that in spy fiction. I wondered if you started out thinking about them as a sort of vehicle for social comment, or whether it just sort of evolved. Do you think the espionage thriller is a good place for sort of satire and social comment? I mean, yours
probably not on the whole. I don't think anyone should go near it with a partner. It's something that evolved. I mean, the humour, the tone of voice in the books was something that, for me, when in writing Slow Horses, was different from the way I'd written before, or perhaps just a more extreme version of what I'd written before. It just seemed to me to be the appropriate way of telling this particular story I was telling, to have that kind of cynical narration going on because of the situation that most of the characters were in. And then as things went on and as the political landscape descended into the chaos of the past decade, really, or however long it's been. It feels like a century, doesn't it? That kind of aspect of the storytelling has grown. I think it probably peaked in London Rules, which was perhaps my Brexit novel, really. There's probably a bit less of that in Joe Country. I think there'll be a bit more of it in the next one, judging by stuff in general going on.
I feel there's a palpable sense of anger in the books. Is that right?
I think there is. I think in London Rules there was. Yes, I mean, I think there is. I think that we've increasingly been governed by people I'm not happy about being governed by, and I mean, covering the whole of the political landscape when I say that. I mean, yeah. And and there is a very real feeling of anger, and I'm writing about anger a lot, certainly at the moment. I'm writing about angry people, people who are angry about, you know, the state of the nation, because that's what's going on. That's what you can see every time you read a newspaper. You know, there's so much of it out there. So it's feeding into the books. And a lot of it, I mean, I feel angry about part of it, but I'm generally speaking quite laid back about everything. I'm quite relaxed. I'm having a great time. You know? The world might be coming apart at the seams, but, you know, I'm enjoying myself, so that's all right. But nevertheless, it's there and available as something that I want to address in what I'm writing. So, yeah.
You have a lot of fun with a number of characters who might just be the tiniest bit inspired by real people. For example, Peter Judd, the Home Secretary with a shock of fluffy blonde hair and a bicycle.
Let me correct
absolutely
you.
Absolutely. No. Oh,
let
sorry.
Me correct
tell
you there.
Correct me.
There is never any point at which I tell you what colour Peter Judd's hair
is. Oh, did you not? I thought there was fluffy hair. Fluffy hair?
Fluffy is not a colour.
That's true. Sorry. You're absolutely right. I've projected.
Projected, yeah. And at one point I describe him as having a haystack of hair. But
haystack.
You look at a haystack and
well,
tell
haystack
what
is.
Brown.
Straw-coloured.
I've seen brown.
Straw-coloured. Okay.
Depends on the time of year.
Right on the edge there. And then there's Dennis...
This is definitely what I'm telling my lawyers, anyway.
Okay. Very sensible. And then there's Dennis Gimble, a very angry little far-right politician who takes all the credit for the Brexit vote, but to whom you give a secret cross-dressing habit, which amused me tremendously.
Well, that was an example.
Oh, and a horrible tabloid columnist wife.
Yeah. I'd actually finished. I was at the publishers before somebody pointed out that there was a particular politician who did have a horrible columnist wife.
Yes.
I was thinking of an entirely different horrible columnist, and I just brought them together. That was the whole cross-dressing thing was an example of what I say about when you're actually doing the writing, things happen that you weren't necessarily aware were going to. I had the character all worked out in my head. And when I started writing the first scene in which he appears, within two sentences of writing that, he was a cross-dresser. He hadn't been.
Right.
It just came out that way. And as soon as that aspect of the character came into being, it became something that I could use in the plot because it becomes a kind of blackmailable, you know, characteristic. So, that was one of the things that obviously has been worked out in the back of my head, but I don't know about it until it comes out of my fingertips. I sound like a robot, don't I?
It's the power of the subconscious. Another thing I wanted to touch on is the way that in each book, Regent's Park is always at least partly to blame for the ensuing chaos, that actually it's either rogue agents initially drafted in by its members or coups set off by Tory politicians or a playbook for destabilising the country, which was written by MI5 and gets into the wrong hands. I mean, I feel that there's a certain truth to this. When I was writing a long time ago my biography of Anthony Blunt, one of the things I noticed was that intelligence agencies often get unstuck in peacetime because they're trying constantly to invent reasons for justifying their own existence. This is something I very much like in your books. Was that something... I feel that must be deliberate, that it's certainly in the first five books, everything really comes out of problems that Regent's Park has created for itself.
I keep trying to cast my net wider, but it always comes back to it. Yeah, that's true, and it's not that I'm necessarily trying to make any point about how the Secret Service operates. I'm simply drawing on the experience of corporations being dysfunctional and, you know, sort of, and also refusing to admit
culpability
to error.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember once at the company I worked for, we'd moved premises and we all got this email saying what our new postcode was. And we were given the wrong postcode. And this led to chaos for a week. You know, nothing was working properly because we were, you know, mailing stuff out and becoming, yeah, it was all going horribly wrong. And when the error was corrected, inverted commas, it went round in an email saying, we are pleased to confirm that our postcode is, and then it gave us the corrected postcode. And this notion that, you know, you can really screw something up that's got the whole company going into a huge mess for a week, and then kind of pretend that this was, you know, not the fault of the person who actually sent the poker around in the first place. I kind of draw on that as being a parable of how I see, you know, corporations operating. Yeah. You know, they mess things up and then they pretend they haven't, and then they say things like, "We are pleased to confirm that, you know, everything is fine."
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I think I've asked too many questions, and I need to throw it open, if we may, to the audience. Does anybody have any questions? In the meantime, I was going to say one of the other things that interests me is the fact that, you know, in most espionage thrillers, the stakes are real and high, and they have world resonating consequences. In your books, the constant implication is that actually this is a totally solipsistic, enclosed world, and, you know, a bunch of intelligence nerds sort of creating their own problems. Again, you know, that was something I know that somebody's actually currently writing a book actually supposed to be reviewing the effect of all that Soviet intelligence over all those years, and whether it made a blind bit of distance apart from the atom bomb. All right, well, actually, look, we're going to start with Joseph, who's right here, and I'll repeat the question.
Now, I have had Slow Horses on my Kindle for a very long time.
Come here.
I haven't read it yet, I have to confess. Is there a relationship, because the sounds are very similar, between Slough House and Slow Horse?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Thank you.
In the books, Slough House is called, I mean, it's up near the Barbican, it's called Slough House because it might as well be in Slough. It's so far removed from the heart
it
of
the
intelligence.
It is the most boring, grim place in the world.
And,
forlorn, exactly.
So the characters get called Slow Horses because of the place being called Slough House. In fact, I had the phrase Slow Horses first, so I invented Slough House in order to be able to call them Slow Horses. I got the phrase Slow Horses from a novel written by Don Winslow, very, very fine American thriller writer.
Very good, yeah.
And it's in the book called The Winter of Frankie Machine, in which he's talking about a gambler and explaining why he's so constantly short of money. It's because he has a peculiar fondness for slow horses. And I read that and thought,
that's it.
I'm having that. Oh, God, that's great. And I got to meet Don Winslow. I've often told that story at public events, but I actually met Don Winslow last year. He's a legendary figure in terrific writer. Very rarely does anything public, but he was in the UK last year, and I met him very briefly, and I told him that, and I was very pleased to be able to do so. And he was a lovely man. Great writer.
Hi, Miranda. Hi, Mick.
Hi.
Everyone hear me all right?
Yeah.
So, Mick, I'm a bookseller, and I've driven other booksellers mad with my LAMP fandom for quite some time. Yeah. And I find the series incredibly fun to recommend for various reasons. It's very funny. It's surprisingly emotionally attached. Mm-hmm. Well, I get attached surprisingly emotionally as I went on. But the thing that I always refer to is the fact that it does feel like it's plotted like clockwork, which goes against what you said when you feel like you're winging it as you write. So I was wondering, how do you find the process once you've actually written this stuff? Like you say, you have a very vague end point that you want to get to. Do you find the editing and the streamlining quite laborious for that? Because by the end, it does feel very airtight.
I wouldn't call it laborious because I enjoy doing it. So it doesn't feel like labor and such. But I do spend a long time doing it. And in Joe Country in particular, there are several chapters where I had to delete essentially a whole chapter and go back because I'd gone along the wrong track. If I'd had a clearer idea of how the plot was going to work, then I'd have a lot less writing to do. But that's just how the process seems to work with me, and I don't worry about it. I'm never in a particular hurry to finish a book, frankly, because if I do, I'll just have to start another one. And that's always a very daunting prospect, you know, starting a novel. Whereas when you're in the middle of one, you know, it's fine, more or less. You know, you can just, you know what you're doing tomorrow, essentially. So that's good. But yes, it does require a lot of second thoughts and dispensing with scenes because they know. I mean, I always take the good bits out, obviously. If there are any jokes that I like, I'll just use them in a different context. characters going places I suddenly realised they shouldn't be there, and that sort of thing. So kind of laborious, but it's just how the process seems to work for me.
I'm a big fan.
We've met before.
Yeah. And I think you're really the successor to Len in the spy-fi world. I mean, it's a tremendous baton to pass on. Bits of Le Carré, yes, when he's being anti-establishment. But trying to find someone with the same voice as you is very hard. Perhaps the early John Gardner when he was spoofing spies in Boyse Oaks. Mm-hmm. But what about Ian Banks? Not really a thriller writer, 2 or 3, Complicity, Transition, Stonemouth, but really with quite a left-wing voice and anti-establishment. What do you think about that comparison?
I'm flattered. I mean, I was a huge admirer of Ian Banks. I love his books. I guess because he was a very witty writer, and I find that the styles that are, it's easiest to be unconsciously start imitating are, you have to have a very strong style, I think, but the comedic writers are the ones who influence. If I've been reading Ian Banks, if I've been reading Kingsley Amis, if I've been reading Christopher Brookmeyer, a great crime writer, I do find that my sentences might start echoing the kind of sentences that they're in. When that happens, I try to delete them and rise above it. But Banks would certainly be one of those writers. I thought he was a great writer, a huge loss. I read his last novel, The Quarry, just a few months ago. I'd had it on my shelf since the month he died, and I hadn't wanted to read it because it felt like saying goodbye to him. He's the only writer I can think of I'd read his first novel when it came out, and I had read everything he'd written ever since. He's the only novelist whom I've had a really sort of long-standing relationship with, who is no longer with us, and that mattered a great deal to me. And it took me a long time to read that book because it did feel like saying goodbye. I never met him. It was purely a reader-author relationship, but it was a very deep one. Yeah.
Well, I think I'm right to say, am I, that your books didn't find their audience immediately in publication, the first one or two anyway. I mean, is that right? And if so, what do you think sort of tipped the balance now that they seem to have found a very large audience?
You're absolutely right. They didn't find an audience straight away. They wouldn't have found an audience yet if it hadn't been for the man sitting to your right. I think every author needs a moment, at least one moment of luck. You can have everything else that a writer requires, but if you don't get lucky, then your books aren't going to reach the audience that they deserve, or reach an audience they don't deserve, perhaps, but nevertheless get out there. And I was lucky enough to have one of my books found. It was Slow Horses, by my publisher at John Murray, when I was being published by an American press. And that changed things, and that wasn't an overnight event either. I mean, an awful lot of effort and several reissues went into getting readership behind these novels. So it requires something far beyond what any individual author has to have a success, and finding the right publisher is a huge part of that process. So yeah, it was luck. And Mark's hugely astute.
And Mark Richards.
of buying the book.
Well, we have sadly finished our hour. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for answering questions.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.